Hello and welcome to The Learning College. I'm Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. And our goal as part of The Learning College is to teach you about the Jew and the true racial and other contexts in which you live, which is not just hidden from you by the powers that be and their institutions and their official voices, but you're gaslit about it. The truth is reversed, not just hidden. So we are now opening today with The People That Shall Dwell Alone by Kevin MacDonald, part of his trilogy, first book. We're on chapter 5. We're going to do about the first half of it, 170 to 188 today. And this is all about, per the title, resource and reproductive competition between Jews and Gentiles. And like last chapter, he was talking about genetic and cultural segregation and separation. He talks about it at different times and places, Jews and Gentiles competing for resources. And, as part of his theory that the group evolutionary strategy is what Jews are doing, forming a team Jew in order to outcompete other groups of hominids, shall we say, to use a less flattering term for people. Anyway, let's dig into chapter 5, 170. Resource and reproductive competition between Jews and Gentiles. And I'm going to try to keep these segments about 15 pages. Sometimes I'll go a little longer. Seems to work out pretty good to about an hour with a little bit of commentary. Resource and reproductive competition between Jews and Gentiles. A couple epigraphs, or one epigraph. One type of Moroccan Muslim folktale depicts the Jews as evildoers who seek to inflict harm upon the Muslims in Islam, but whose nefarious machinations are thwarted. Another type consists of humorous stories in which the Jew tries to get the better of the Muslim, but is outwitted by the latter. Moroccan Jew stories. And also, the Moroccan Jewish folktales present a reverse image of the Jewish-Muslim contest of wits. In them, it is not the Muslim, but the Jew who wins. They tell of rivalry between a righteous Jewish and a wicked Muslim courtier, of clashes between a Jew and a Muslim in which the clever Jew triumphs over the foolish Muslim, of kings of Marrakesh favorably disposed to the Jews. That's from Patai, P-A-T-I-I, is a guy cited a lot, 1986. So, dueling folktales and myths and jokes, featuring the group telling it as the winner between Jews and Moroccan Muslims. MacDonald says, the preceding chapters indicate that throughout its history, Judaism may be conceptualized as a group that has maintained genetic and cultural separatism from Gentile societies while living as a diaspora among them. So they're spread out little groups of Jews in all the Goyish nations. Called a diaspora, and their term is they're in Galut, they're in exile from where they're supposed to be, Jerusalem and Israel, Zion. As indicated in chapter 1, this state of affairs may be conceptualized as a pseudo-speciation, and the evolutionist must then attempt to characterize the ecological relationship between the pseudo-species. I guess that means they're not true species, but they're heading in that direction, and if they continue, eventually they would be a separate species. We have seen that an important aspect of traditional Jewish religious ideology has been that Judaism has an altruistic role to play vis-a-vis the Gentile world. That was we heard last time, that was how Reformed Jews, after the emancipation, re-stylized themselves, or re-presented themselves, or reframed themselves, or reinterpreted themselves. We're just like everyone else, but we're also chosen and better, and we're an example and a light unto nations, and that's why we need to stick together and take advantages of the full opportunities available to us as full, legal, equal citizens while retaining our particularity. We want it both ways at all times, anything less than anti-Semitic. So what, and MacDonald calls that an aspect of their traditional Jewish religious ideology, that Judaism is somehow altruistic toward non-Jews, the Gentile world. An evolutionary perspective suggests, rather, that all humans possess adaptations that motivate them to attempt to control resources and achieve reproductive success. The present chapter indicates that not uncommonly Jews and Gentiles have had conflicts of interest over control of resources, and that these conflicts have had implications for differential reproductive success between Jews and Gentiles. Further, although resource competition is clearly not the only factor involved in anti-Semitism, data reviewed here support the proposition that resource competition has often exacerbated anti-Semitism. Footnote 1, endnote 1. We'll get to those next segment when we finish the chapter. But Jews as intermediaries in traditional societies. So again, we're looking at different times and places. So traditional societies, Jews as intermediaries. It must be noted at the outset that there has been a recurring situation related to Jewish economic and reproductive competition. In traditional societies, Jews have commonly been utilized as an intermediary group between a ruling elite, and especially alien elites, and the native population. In these situations, the elite Gentile group has often actively encouraged Jewish economic interests to the detriment of other sectors of the native population. Thus, Baer, 1961, notes that Jews tended to become prominent in autocratic societies rather than in those in which there was a powerful aristocracy. Quote, in a republic headed by aristocratic families, there was no room for Jewish statesmen. On the other hand, a monarch or other autocrat, the absolute ruler over an unfriendly native population, would attract to his service Jews, the perpetual aliens, on whose loyal support he could count in securing his regime. This phenomenon, in varying forms, manifested itself time and again also in the history of Christian Europe. You know, we hear the church is protecting whites from Jews, which is not true. The church protected Jews from whites. Thus, for example, in medieval England, the Jewish population was utilized as a source of revenue for the king, while very hostile attitudes toward Jews developed among the aristocracy and the peasants. Ultimately, the increasing power of the aristocracy was an important factor in the eventual expulsion of the Jews, and the expulsion was also highly popular among the peasants and the clergy. Using foreigners as intermediaries is an example of a general phenomenon noticed by Balch, B-A-L-C-H, 1986, who finds that despotic rulers have often attempted to develop a bureaucracy made up of individuals with no family or kinship ties, and thus no loyalty, to the people who were being ruled. The evolutionary aspects of this situation are obvious. Jews were the ideal intermediary for any exploitative elite precisely because their interests as a genetically segregated group were maximally divergent from those of the exploited population. Such individuals are expected to have maximal loyalty to the rulers and minimal concerns about behaving in a purely instrumental manner, including exploitation, toward the rest of the population. So these kings or monarchs are finding they can use these eternal outsiders to rule over the local population and exploit them. Katz expresses it well when he notes in his comments on the economic position of the Ashkenazi Jews in 16th to 18th century Europe that, quote, since Jewish society was segregated religiously and socially from the other classes, its attitude toward them was likely to be almost purely instrumental. Instrumental means how can I use them to achieve my end? Use them as a tool. They're my instrument. The non-Jew had no fear that the Jew would take a partisan stand in the struggle between the rulers and the ruled, who bore the economic yoke of the political privileges enjoyed by the rulers. The corollary of this, says MacDonald, is that anti-Semitism has tended to have strong popular roots in traditional societies, and that autocratic rulers and aristocratic elements who are least in competition with Jews have often been forces against anti-Semitism. Writing of the period after the Thirty Years' War, Israel, 1985, notes that in Central Europe, the trend was for princes to develop Jewish policies that were completely contrary to the interests of the populace and the clergy. Repeated instances are given in which the nobility extended invitations to Jewish merchants and traders despite the vehement objections of native commercial interests. These findings are congruent with cross-cultural research indicating that elites around the world tend to be far more individualistic and have less loyalty to the group than lower status individuals. Triandis, 1990 and 91. Elites are unlikely to identify with the interests of the society as a whole, and they are relatively eager to agree to arrangements that are personally beneficial, even if they negatively impact other groups of the society. This phenomenon is therefore not restricted to Jews, but Jews as, quote, perpetual aliens, unquote, have often been utilized in this role. Shibatuni and Kwan note many such examples, including East Indians in Burma, the Chinese in several areas of Asia, Middle Easterners, Greeks, Syrians, Lebanese, serving as middlemen between colonial Europeans and Africans, Indians in East Africa, and Arabs in Indonesia. In all of these cases, the middlemen were highly vulnerable since their power came from a dominant elite, and especially so in times of stress. Quote, in effect, the price the minority pays for protection in times of minimal stress is to be placed on the front lines of battle in any showdown between the elite and the peasant groups. Blaylock, 1967. In the present chapter, evidence will be provided for this phenomenon both in Sephardic Spain under Christian and Muslim rulers, and among the Ashkenazi Jews in Europe, dating from the early modern period in Poland, and echoed in alliances between Jewish financiers and the ruling aristocracy in 19th century Western Europe. However, this type of relationship between Jewish and Gentile populations has been found even in antiquity at the very dawn of diaspora Judaism. Baron notes that the Jews had a special status as imperial clients of the Persian government in the 5th century BC in the Elephantine province in Egypt. However, quote, this governmental favoritism brought about a natural resentment in the native majority. Later, during the Hellenistic period, Seleucid and Ptolemaic rulers settled Jews in Osroene, Cyrenaica, Egypt, Syria, Parthia, and throughout western Anatolia, Turkey. These colonists typically were allowed to live according to their own laws, i.e. in a culturally separatist manner. The Jews had a status midway between citizens and resident aliens, and they acted as a counterforce to the local Greco-Asiatic populations. When the power of the Hellenistic kings declined, tensions between Jews living in their separated communities and the citizens increased, and there were attempts to abolish Jewish privileges. Baron also suggests that the diaspora Jews were useful to the authorities in the Roman Empire because of their lack of interest in the nationalistic strivings of the local populations. Similarly, Stillman notes several such instances in the Muslim world in which foreign rulers used Jews as intermediaries over subject populations. For example, Jews prospered during the Fatimid occupation of Tunisia, 10th century, during and following the Arab conquest of Spain, 8th to 11th centuries, during and following the Arab conquest of, see also Castro, 1954, during the early period following Mongol rule in Iraq, 13th century, during the Marinid occupation of Morocco, 13th to 15th centuries, during the early Ottoman period, 16th century, in 20th century Morocco, where after 1912, they formed a layer between the French colonial government and the Muslim population as part of the French government's divisé pour régner, divide to rule, colonial policy in which minorities, including Jews, were actively encouraged in a role over subject populations, and in the regime of the outsider King Faisal, outsider in quotes, in 20th century Iraq. Finally, in the post-World War II era, Jews were useful to the Soviets in establishing anti-popular satellite governments in Eastern Europe, Hungary and such, Yugoslavia, Romania, in Iraq, 1291, Spain, 1066, Tunisia, 1012, Morocco, 1276, 1465, and Jewish settlements in Ottoman areas, end of the 16th century and during the 19th century following the civil emancipation of the Jews. These interludes of prosperity were punctuated by violent popular anti-Jewish uprisings occurring concomitantly with the decline of control by the central government. Coincident with this role as intermediary between ruling elites and the rest of the population has been a strong tradition in which Jews who were prominently placed among the Gentile power structure furthered the aims of their co-religionists, a phenomenon that is intimately related to the Jewish emphasis on elitism in education and marriage. see chapter 7, as well as the importance of altruism and cooperation within the Jewish community. Think of all the Jews around Trump. See chapter 6, the archetype of the well-placed courtier who helps other Jews while oppressing the local population is Joseph in the biblical account of the sojourn in Egypt. Joseph intercedes with the Pharaoh on behalf of his family. Quote, then Joseph settled his father and his brothers and gave them a possession in the land of Egypt, in the best of the land. Genesis 47:11. However, the account also emphasizes Joseph's role in oppressing the Egyptians on behalf of the king. Joseph sells grain to the Egyptians during a famine until he has all of their money. He then requires the Egyptians to give their livestock for food, and finally, their land. Quote, the land became the Pharaoh's, and as for the people, he made slaves of them from one end of Egypt to the other. Genesis 47:20-21. However, regarding the Israelites, the section continues, thus Israel dwelt in the land of Egypt, in the land of Goshen, and they gained possessions in it, and were fruitful and multiplied exceedingly. Genesis 47:27. The prototypical Jewish role as an instrument of governmental oppression has been that of tax farmer. Endnote 3. This phenomenon appears to have been begun in ancient times, tax farming. Although the details, that is basically the Jewish pays a licensing fee to franchise out the local goyim from the white king. That's how racially loyal whites are. The white masses are vegetables and the Jew gets to farm them and milk them and make creams and soups and whatever else he wants out of the white vegetables, and he has the right, he's renting the land from the king, who's of the same race as the vegetables he's farming. Although the details of the account are disputed by some historians, Josephus describes Joseph, a Jew in the court of the Ptolemies, who was an extremely effective tax farmer whose bid was twice as high as the bids of the local principal men and rulers of the area where taxes were collected. Quote, the king was pleased to hear that offer, and because it augmented his revenues, said he would confirm the sale of the taxes to him, the right to tax collect among in a certain district or area. Joseph obtained compliance by killing prominent citizens and confiscating their property in areas that refused to pay their taxes, thereby stripping Syria, quote, to the bone. However, Joseph became very wealthy and was instrumental in aiding his co-religionists. Josephus concludes that Joseph, quote, was a good man and of great magnanimity and brought the Jews out of a state of poverty and meanness to one that was more splendid. That's from Antiquities of the Jews by Josephus, 12:224. However, while it has generally been true that Jewish populations in traditional societies existed at the sufferance of Gentile elites who benefited from them in some way, the economic role of Jews often extended far beyond that of being merely agents of princely oppression. It will be seen that, with the exception of primary or agricultural production, and in the absence of powerful controls on Jewish economic behavior, Jewish-Gentile resource competition extended throughout the economy to include trade, merchandising, moneylending, manufacturing, and artisanry. This generalized resource competition between foreign ethnic groups and native populations is also not unique to the relationships between Jews and Gentiles. Zenner, 1991, describes a wide range of restrictions enacted against diaspora Chinese as a result of resource competition with native populations. For example, the Chinese were prohibited from owning land in Java and California and were expelled from Sonora in the 1920s. Pogroms against Chinese residents occurred in Indonesia in the 1950s, and in Sumatra, the nationalist government attempted to replace Chinese traders with natives. Endnote 4. And again, we heard more along those lines in the first preface, Diaspora Peoples. New subtitle, The Sephardic Jews in the Iberian Peninsula. Iberia would be Spain, Portugal. Bear notes repeatedly that the kings of Spain throughout the period of reconquests over several hundred, like 700 years, the Spains drove the Moors and the Jews out of Spain and reconquered it for the Christian whites from the Moors, while the Jews were helping the Muslims. Bear notes repeatedly that the kings of Spain, throughout the period of reconquest, viewed the Jews as performing indispensable functions, especially the collection of taxes via tax farming. See also Castro and Neumann. Quote, barring temporary fluctuations caused by war, anarchy, or civil strife, it was the fixed policy of Spanish rulers for over 500 years to conserve and increase the number of Jews in their provinces and to protect their interests against the encroachments of the other elements of the Spanish population. So the Spanish kings are using the Jews to tax farm. Moreover, Baer describes repeated attempts by kings to prevent anti-Semitic laws and behavior in Spain prior to the Inquisition. Or he shows that kings agreed to anti-Semitic measures only as a result of pressure from other classes in society, including the nobility, the clergy, and the popular masses. Even on the eve of the Inquisition, and only 10 years prior to the expulsion, King Ferdinand in 1481 wrote letters condemning anti-Semitic actions to the prelates of Saragossa, but did not send them on the advice of his counselors, who told him of the popular hatred and violence against Jews in that city. Castro suggests that Ferdinand's reluctant actions against the Jews stem from the fact that the kingdom had become ungovernable in view of the hatred of the lower clergy and the masses, quote, especially if it was necessary to use the people to wage wars in distant lands. Supporting the thesis that of a general alliance between the king and the Jews, Baer notes a tendency such that, quote, every interregnum, the period between kings, was likely to bring disaster down upon the Jews when they didn't have a king to protect them, because they were between kings, including the disaster of 1391, in which there were widespread persecutions and forced conversions of Jews. Now, Catholics would say it's against the law to forcibly convert, although they define that fairly openly. It has to be a conversion of their own free will, and once they do that, there's no backsliding, and that's who the Inquisition would be against, rather than being against Jews proper, because the Catholic position is you can't convert anyone by force. It has to be of their own free will, but that can be kind of loosely defined. Quote, the lower classes, not the upper, were behind the expulsion of the Jews, who were protected by the upper classes for centuries against all manner of attack and abuse. Resource competition and anti-Semitism, therefore, came from the non-royal estates of Spain. Thus, for example, in 1283, the clergy, nobility, and burghers attempted to end the Jewish influence in government, each estate having its own interest in competition with the Jews. Hilgarth notes that the resulting limitations on Jewish competition resulted in an expansion of opportunities for the non-Jewish bourgeoisie. Early in the 14th century, the king reappointed Jewish tax farmers with the result that, quote, the old rivalries between the Christian and Jewish courtiers thereupon flared up anew. Quote, every important post held by a Jew was deeply resented by the many disgruntled noblemen who coveted the office. Neumann, 1969, or Neumann. Besides rivalries among Jewish and non-Jewish courtiers, there was a gradually increasing tide of popular anti-Semitism dating from at least the 11th century, which culminated in the anti-Jewish riots of 1391, the anti-converso riots of the 15th century, of the 1400s, and eventually the Inquisition itself, citing Beinart, Hallezer, and Leah and Roth. Even in the latter part of the 13th century, the end of the 1200s, Baer writes of, quote, deep and widespread unrest, unquote, resulting in anti-Semitic actions. Neumann describes the, quote, ever-present danger from the surrounding population, unquote, and the bitter economic rivalry between the Jews and the burghers who, quote, sought to impose legal restrictions on them in order to cripple them in the competitive struggle, unquote, including restrictions on engaging in handicrafts and trade, and even barring Jews from entering into contracts of any kind with Christians. In the 1370s, anti-Semitism was strongest among the urban lower classes, quote, the artisans who aspired to wrest control of the municipalities and the mendicant friars who mingled with the poor. Indeed, regarding the riots of 1391, the king made active efforts to defend the Jews, prosecute the offenders, and rehabilitate the Jewish communities after the riots. The rioters, on the other hand, were mainly, quote, little people, although, quote, in every locality, noble families and even priests had been involved in the crimes. Castro writes of the conflicting interests of the opposed castes, i.e. Spaniards, Muslims, and Jews, a conflict that, quote, was translated into the enmity of the lower classes toward the bourgeoisie of the cities, who were qualified for leadership by their culture, their economic power, their administrative and technical efficiency, and who were, irremediably, Hispano-Judaic. Besides direct competition among artisans and over jobs in public administration, several authors have noted that popular anti-Semitism derived from Jewish moneylending and especially tax farming. Neumann notes that, quote, as the Jews were conspicuously identified with the collection of the royal revenue, and the people groaned under the burden of taxes, the Jewish officials were hated by the populace as tools of oppression. Direct quote. In the event, the anti-Jewish activities of the Inquisition had, quote, near unanimous popular support throughout the Iberian Peninsula. Except they weren't operating against Jews, they were operating against Catholics, that is, Jews who had converted. The popular uprisings against the Jews in the 14th and 15th century were often fomented by the church, which was also in competition with the Jews. For example, Jewish domination of the Castilian king, Pedro the Cruel, was used as a political weapon by his victorious enemies in a fratricidal war, civil war, ending in 1369, with the result that the power of the church increased and the power of the Jews decreased at the royal court. Citing Baer. Castro, 1954, notes that from the church's point of view, the alliance between the government and the Jews in the area of fiscal affairs and tax farming deprived the church of revenue. Quote, a permanent abyss was carved between the people and the government, and also between the state and the church, because in the Jew, the kings had a convenient source of income, and in the church, a rival that was taking it away from them. Castro also notes that, quote, churchmen of lesser rank never ceased complaining of the favor shown by the Jews by the Spanish monarchs. In the long run, the government was unable to oppose this ecclesiastical popular alliance. Ultimately, it was the clergyman Ferdinand Martinez who fomented the popular discontent that resulted in the massacres of 1391 and ultimately led to the Inquisition. Castro, 1954. Notes that, quote, in the 13th and 14th century, the Jew had dreamed of the possibility of dominating Castile, the new promised land, that's a section of Spain, Leon, Castile, Aragon, etc. He had in his hands the promotion and administration of wealth of the kingdom, as well as the technical and scientific knowledge possible at that time, close quote. Resource competition and the belief that the Jews were intent on dominating Spain intensified in the period following the forced conversions of 1391, since there were no longer any restrictions on the upward mobility of the conversos as there had been on the Jews. Endnote 9. In the period following the riots of 1391, Jews who had been forcibly converted, quote, continued to maintain the hold of their class and race on trading and capital. Kamen, Johnson, Roth, and Salomon write of the conflict between the Spanish masses and the conversos that developed when the latter had entered Spanish society in the 15th century, quote, quickly penetrating the ranks of the Castilian middle and upper classes and occupying the most prominent positions in the royal administration and the church hierarchy. So they, as soon as they convert to the church, even there, they're dominating at the top. The economic progress of the conversos and their descendants was phenomenally rapid. The law, the administration, the army, the universities, the church itself were all overrun by recent converts of more or less questionable sincerity or by their immediate descendants. So just as they overran the U.S. after 1880, they did the same thing in Spain. Immediately taken over, they did the same thing after they were loosed by Napoleon from their ghettos. They thronged the financial administration, for which they had a natural aptitude, protest being now impossible. They pushed their way into the municipal councils, into the legislatures, into the judiciary. They all but dominated Spanish life. The wealthier amongst them intermarried with the highest nobility of the land. That's from Roth. Indeed, Walsh describes a common belief during the period that the, quote, new Christians were planning to rule Spain, enslave the Christians, and establish a new Jerusalem in the West. 12. These beliefs were abetted by two tracts written by the converso Selimo ha-Levi, formerly a highly respected rabbi, but later the Bishop of Burgos, in which he declared that the Jews were attempting to rule Spain. Another common belief was that the conversos had infiltrated both the aristocracy and the church and were attempting to destroy Spanish society from within. Resource competition appears to be an important factor in the anti-converso activities of the 15th century. Thus, the anti-converso riots of 1449 in Ciudad Real, like those in Toledo and elsewhere, were the result of the increasing political and economic influence of the conversos at the municipal level, with the result that, quote, it was notaries, ayudes, and other office holders and notables who were the first to be hit, Beinart and Common. The riots of 1474 were, quote, concerted actions by local inhabitants, riots of 1474. Guilds were organized along ethnic lines during the converso, obviously that means converts, period, prior to the Inquisition, so that economic competition between Jews and Gentiles continued even after surface religious group membership ceased to differentiate the two groups. Moreover, the legal exclusion of conversos from some craft guilds and the city offices prior to the Inquisition suggests Jewish competition with the Gentile non-aristocracy was an issue. Since the church was an important avenue of upward mobility, another source of competition between the new and old Christians was access to the ecclesiastical administration. Many authors have noted the penetration of the conversos into high positions in the church, and Common notes the struggle between the conversos and the old Christians over access to the ecclesiastical administration. The old Christians, quote, resented sharing power with men of mixed race and doubtful orthodoxy, close quote. The clergyman Fray Alonso, a major instigator of the Inquisition, is depicted as angered by seeing the large number of conversos filling important posts in the court of Queen Isabella. When Archbishop Siliceo, a man of humble origin, advocated limpieza, i.e. purity of blood, statutes to deny conversos access to the church, and MacDonald or Jones cites that as like the first sort of racial viewing of the Jews. So even though they didn't have all the racial signs, whatever, they knew Jews were inherently a different people and it wasn't a matter of belief. So racial sense and even implicit science is nevertheless coming to the fore contrary to Catholic dogma, because dogma doesn't make facts go away. That race doesn't matter, that race isn't real, or whatever they want to claim. So again, limpieza, that means limpiar is to clean in Spanish, the verb limpieza, purity of blood, statutes to deny conversos access to the church, he was in effect making a brief for a privileged access to resources for his social class. And really, I gotta say, I mean, MacDonald is writing as an academic, but this stuff is much better treated the way Jones does or the way a political writer would, because he's kind of abstractly and almost deliberately boringizing it into, you know, groups competing for resources, and I guess that's what he has to do as an academic, but it doesn't really capture the flavor of the thing. It doesn't matter if you drip baptismal water on them. It doesn't matter if you call them Christians. Jews are a specific kind of animal, and they act in specific ways, and these ways are found wherever they go, whether it's hot, dusty Spain or Africa or the Middle East or Germany or Poland or France or England or the USA. They act the same way. They flock to the same areas. They attempt the same dominations through the same techniques, always taking advantage of whatever the latest technology is, too. That's the flavor, you know. So similarly, the Portuguese New Christians in the 16th century moved up socially even more rapidly than did the Spanish New Christians, capital NC, in the previous century. So the New Christians in Spain in the 1400s and the New Christians in Portugal in the 1500s moved even faster. Quote, their wealth was enormous. They almost monopolized commerce, says Roth. And they became, and remember, that's where the slave trade came from those Portuguese going down the coast of Africa originally. And they became well established in politics, literature, medicine, the military, and even the clergy. Quote, they grew rich and prosperous. They intermarried with the noblest houses, and they largely entered the church. Much of the active capital of the kingdom was in their hands. There is also evidence of a contemporary concern with Jewish reproductive success. Andres Bernaldez, a defender of the Inquisition and self-conscious spokesman for the viewpoint of the masses, noted that the conversos had risen, quote, to the rank of scholars, doctors, bishops, canons, priests and priors of monasteries, auditors and secretaries, farmers of crown revenues and grandees. They had one aim, to increase and multiply. Quoted in Beinart, 1981, see also Longhurst, 1964. Indeed, the bull of Pope Sixtus IV of 1478, establishing the authority for the Inquisition, noted not only that there were crypto-Jews, but also that, quote, their numbers increase, not a little, close quote. Quoted in Walsh, 1940. Concerns about the reproductive success of Jews and their descendants extended well beyond the beginning of the Inquisition. Barron, 1973, refers to widespread concern about the reproductive success of the new Christians in early 17th century Spain and Portugal. For example, Barron notes that a conference of theologians concluded in 1629 that the descendants of Jews proliferated like, quote, the sands of the sea, 14. Resource competition between new Christians and old Christians also continued long after the establishment of the Spanish and Portuguese Inquisitions. Boyajian recounts the opposition of Spanish merchants to the increasing influence of Portuguese new Christians at the Madrid court beginning in the 1620s as a result of the new Christian involvement in financing the Spanish monarchy. So in the 1400s, 1500s, they're rising up in Spain and Portugal, encountering riots, Inquisition, protests, but they're still getting to the top, their numbers are multiplying, and they're starting to spread out and do the slave trade, etc. Remember, the first Christians arriving in North America, what, 1609, 1620, around there? That period, anyway. In order to obtain the cooperation of the new Christians, the monarchy supported granting the demands of the new Christians, including relaxing the Inquisition, giving them the right to participate in Spanish trading ventures, and allowing them to enter military orders of the aristocracy, which had been closed off by limpieza laws, or blood purity laws. However, these interests conflicted with the interests of the old Christian merchants in Seville and elsewhere in the Spanish Empire, and the latter found powerful allies in the churches and the Inquisitions of Spain, Portugal, and the New World. Although the monarchy advanced these causes and protected the new Christians for a considerable period, the old Christian courtiers, urban patricians and merchants and churchmen eventually prevailed, and the Inquisition and its concern with limpieza were reinvigorated, especially in the period following the independence of Portugal in 1640. End note 15. A very interesting case involving Sephardic Jews after their emigration from the Iberian Peninsula is represented by Venice in the 16th century. In Venice, Jews competed successfully against the local merchants and, quote, aroused great jealousy, Roth, 1974, leading to a temporary expulsion from Venice. Davidson finds that anti-Semitic sentiments in 16th century Venice, quote, were often inspired by economic rivalry, and notes the development of Christian sources of credit by wealthy families attempting to avoid Jewish moneylenders. In the words of two contemporary Venetian patricians, Jewish moneylending is the means by which they, quote, consume and devour the people of this, our city. It is of interest, however, that the Venetian authorities eventually developed very precise and minutely detailed regulations on Jewish economic activity, which appear to have minimized anti-Semitism because the Jewish economic role was intended to, quote, complement rather than compete with the activities of long-established Venetian nobility and citizenry. Pulan, P-U-L-L-A-N, 1983. Jews were forbidden to own land, could not become artisans or engage in manufacturing, and could only charge 5% interest on loans. 16. The result was that, quote, Venetians in general could not be relied upon to despise or detest them, say perhaps at certain seasons of the year, such as Carnival or Passiontide. The role of this intensive regulation of Jewish economic activity in minimizing anti-Semitism was recognized by a contemporary rabbi who, describing the causes of anti-Semitism elsewhere, noted that, block quote, usury makes them unpopular with all the orders of the city. Engaging in crafts with the lesser people, the possession of property with nobles and great men, these are the reasons why the Jews do not dwell in many places. But these circumstances do not arise in Venice, where the rate of interest is only 5%, and the banks are established for the benefit of the poor and not for the profit of the bankers. The Jews cannot engage in crafts or manufacture, nor can they own real property. Hence, they do not seem burdensome or threatening to any estate or order within the city. Quoted in Pulan, 1983. However, these restrictions did not prevent continuing hostilities centering around Jewish competition in trade, and there was concern that Jews would emigrate to the Levant with the great wealth obtained by trading in Venice, and that this wealth would eventually benefit the Turks in their war with Venice. So people know that Jews are working with the Muslims against the whites of Europe. Eventually, the government allowed Jews to dominate trade at the expense of Gentile traders and was content to profit from the taxes generated by this economic activity. However, despite the decline of Venetian Gentile traders, the Gentile community as a whole may have continued to benefit from the international Jewish trading network, since, besides taxes, the exported goods and the goods and services consumed by the Jewish community were manufactured by Gentiles. The example is instructive because it indicates that in traditional societies, a sort of win-win economic situation could exist in which Jewish economic activity benefited the society as a whole. However, the example also shows that this type of situation occurred only when there were very powerful, rigidly enforced controls on Jewish economic activity. In the absence of such controls, the evidence from this chapter indicates that there is a general tendency for resource competition with most sectors of the Gentile economy in traditional societies. So yeah, they're pretty much after them on all fronts except agriculture. They let the goyim do the work and they reap the middleman rewards. And finally, one more subsection before we close today, which is Ashkenazi Jews in Early Modern Poland. Well, let's see here. There is excellent evidence for resource competition between Jews and non-Jews throughout Polish history, as well as for the hypothesis of a significant alliance between the Jews and the aristocracy, as we saw in Spain. In the post-medieval period in Poland, most Jews lived in privately owned towns, and the owners often encouraged Jewish settlement. The Polish nobility welcomed Jews as estate managers and toll farmers, bankers and moneylenders. They also encouraged Jewish trade and commerce because, as a consuming class, they benefited from the lower prices brought on by competition, citing Weinrib, Hundert, Katz, Tallet. The preponderance of Jewish economic activity was ultimately the result of franchises derived from the nobility, but eventually, due to increasing numbers, Jews began engaging in non-franchised economic activity such as artisanry, activity that brought them into direct competition with other sectors of the Polish population. There was competition between Gentile and Jewish craftsmen such as butchers, tailors, blacksmiths, and shoemakers, in which non-Jewish guilds attempted to eliminate Jewish craftsmen, citing Katz and Weinrib. Moreover, non-Jewish merchants often viewed Jews as competitors, and there were periodic attempts to restrict Jewish trade and business, especially in areas where Jews lived on lands owned by the king. For example, in 1485, there was an agreement between the Jewish community and the city council of Krakow, in which the Jews agreed to give up trade and most selling, and in 1764, Jews were barred from trade in cattle, grain, and horses. In the 16th century, Jewish rights of commerce were limited in several cities, and other cities were granted the privilege of excluding Jews altogether. In the late 19th century, the Galician government organized an economic boycott of Jewish businesses with the slogan of, quote, "Buy from your own kind," Lippmann, 1984. With the result that the Jewish population suffered an economic decline and many emigrated. That was the late 19th century. Galician government, buy from your own kind. Those were considered like the rattiest types of Jews, the Galicians, the lowest form of Jew scum. Nevertheless, despite recurrent restrictions and exclusions, Jews had essentially won this competition in the areas of trade and artisanry by the time of the 1764 census. Clear, 1986, K-L-I-E-R. Hundert notes that Jews increasingly dominated small-scale domestic commerce and, by the 18th century, they dominated trade with the West as well. The Jewish share of commerce, quote, increased dramatically from the 16th to the 18th century. Beauvoir notes that there were 12,285 Jewish merchants compared to 1,790 Christian merchants, like six times as many Jews, in previously Polish provinces of the Russian Empire in 1840. Moreover, there is considerable evidence that some Jewish families obtained great wealth. Quote, Jews in Poland were building tax farming, estate leasing, and commercial empires, erecting large houses to live in, and trying to amass, to some extent successfully, large fortunes to leave to their children. Weinrib, 1972. These trends are well captured in the case study of the town of Opatow, O-P-A-T-A-O-W, from the 17th through the 18th century, 1600s and 1700s. Case study of Opatow, Hundert. Jews began settling there in the 16th century, and even in 1569 there was an indication of concern by Christian merchants about Jewish competition. In the 17th century, there was a gradual rise in the percentage of trade controlled by Jews in the region, and Jews began to lease the estates of the noblemen who owned the town. Already in the 17th century, Jews were reluctant to join Christian guilds, and there were anti-Semitic incidents. By the end of the 18th century, Jews dominated almost all areas of trading, manufacturing, and estate managing, and they had become dominant among the artisans as well. Competition was most intense between Jewish and Christian artisans, and there were constant complaints that Jews refused to join Christian guilds and that they controlled the trade in raw materials, that they imported finished products into the town, and that they encouraged Jews not to buy from Christians, complaints that were common throughout Poland at the time. By the end of the 18th century, there were Jewish guilds for butchers, furriers, and hat makers, and Christians had been almost completely displaced as butchers, bakers, tailors, furriers, and goldsmiths. Corresponding with these developments, Christians increasingly abandoned artisanry in order to work in agriculture. Similarly, in the area of commerce, Jews were accused of not participating in Christian guilds, and, quote, there were complaints that Jews had pushed Christians entirely out of commerce, Hundert, 1992, with the result that Christian merchants were forced to move elsewhere. Reflecting the separate worlds of Jew and Gentile in the town, Jewish merchants complained when a Greek merchant hired a Jewish agent to promote business, with the result that the Greek was forced to hire someone of his own religion. Following this, quote, Jewish domination of the town's commerce was almost complete, end quote. Finally, Jews came to dominate all phases of the alcoholic beverage business, including manufacture, distribution, and retail. Footnote 18, or endnote. The Jewish community generally prospered not only economically, but also reproductively during this period. The Jewish expansion into almost all phases of the economy supported a Jewish population of Opatow that increased dramatically from the late 17th century until about 1770. Although the Jewish population then stagnated or declined somewhat, there was increasing emigration to surrounding towns and to Warsaw by Jews who could not be supported in the local economy. Clearly, the economic success of the Jews had translated into a high level of reproductive success as well. So this is really where the bulk of the Jewish population was grown, was in Poland, which they came to dominate over a couple of centuries, as he's pointing out. This increasing Jewish economic domination resulted in clashes with the Gentile population most affected by this competition. Weinrib notes that in all these attempts to exclude or limit Jews and other minorities from trade and crafts, as in the staged violence, it was the lower strata of the city, the small trader, the artisan, and the mob who were in the forefront of the struggle. The urban elite, the wealthy merchants, were generally less apt to fear Jewish or any other competition. Close quote. Writing of the 19th century, Kinowitz notes that mistrust and hatred were common between Jewish and Christian shopkeepers, peddlers, and middlemen. Finally, despite the general alliance between the Jews and the nobility, there was significant competition, at least some of the time, between Jews and all except the very highest levels of Polish society. Weinrib, and see also Tollett, 1T, notes that in the 15th century, the lower nobility competed with the Jews in the areas of agricultural export and toll farming. Laws were made to prevent Jews from lending money, to restrict the interest rates charged by Jews, and to prevent Jews from farming tolls. Weinrib also describes a concern among the nobility for the, quote, huge increase, close quote, in the Jewish population and their, quote unquote, fabulous wealth, which resulted in various restrictions on Jews. And that ends the subsection talking about Jews in Poland. So there we see they're in competition. They're being used by Gentiles. They're being hated by Gentiles because they're lording it over them and charging them high rates of interest. And there's all kinds of clashes. And the whites aren't unified. The Jews are. And wherever the Jews are allowed to basically compete, they're going to win because of their intense nepotism more than any other reason. Their strong sense of who they are. They know who they are and what they're after, and they work as a group, and they're loyal to each other, and that's how they get ahead. And there is not that among whites. There may be among small sectors of whites, but whites do not have a team the way Jews do, and that's why they are losing to Jews in these competitions. And that's our lesson for today at the Learning College. Thanks for being with me. I'll be back with you again for more from Chapter 5 of Kevin MacDonald's A People That Shall Dwell Alone real soon.